Hello and welcome to Upland Lives. My name is Mike Raine, author of Nature of Snowdonia. This podcast is free to air, ad-free and music-free. You can find out more about me and my workshops and e-learning modules at mikeraine.co.uk. My guest today is Dave Phillips. Dave is a bushcrafter. Dave runs The Coastal Wanderer, a small company which aims to introduce people to bushcrafting and foraging. Now, I'm particularly keen to talk to Dave on behalf of Mountain Leaders today because bushcrafting, in my experience, elicits a bit of a mixed response from many of us in the outdoor community. And it does seem to cover quite a wide range of activities. And we've all seen some bad practice. We've all seen some dodgy firelighting and so-called wild camping, particularly over the last couple of years. And we often are very quick to blame bushcraft TV, some dreadful TV shows promoting this sort of behaviour. And we've all seen the sort of military wannabes in cotton camo gear as well. So I thought it was best and about time that we actually talked to somebody who knows what they're talking about. And we've got the lowdown on the bushcraft world. So Dave, thanks for joining us today. It's a lovely sunny day outside as we're recording this. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm great. Enjoying the weather. Looking forward to getting out and doing a bit after Christmas and just settling down for a nice bit of a break, to be honest.
Yeah, that's great. Me too. So busy. What we better start with is, what do we mean by bushcraft and or foraging? What do I actually mean by those things? And then I'll ask you how you come to be doing it.
Right. Bushcraft. Much maligned term. And it's an absolutely massive subject. I have to say there are some people out there who might watch television, pick up a few things, get some outdoor gear and go out and do a bit. And that's fine if they respect the countryside. But bushcraft itself is very in-depth. You know, some of my guys that I work with are some really good professional guys, like John Ryder from down in Sussex. He is a bushcrafter, but his bushcraft is way different to what I do. He can track things. He actually was showing me how to track a daddy long legs across mud. And I just saw a patch of mud. Wow. He saw where daddy long legs had been.
That's amazing.
He is phenomenal. He was top end. But he's got a good, really good knowledge across the board. And again, we can sit around the fire and he can do his lecture on scat, rows and rows of scat. Whereas I'm sort of on the other side of the spectrum, I can take you on a beach on a windy day, stand you there and bore you with less about seaweed. We've all got the same base layer of knowing about woodlands and coastal areas and the basis of fire lighting, but we all have different streams where we go and become a bit more proficient in it. So it matters.
Yeah, so how did you get into the bit you do then? How did it kick off for you, Dave?
Well, again, it's one of these things, all the people that I know who I think are good bushcrafters, they develop organically. I would class myself as a country guy, a country boy. Born and brought up in Northumberland on the Duke of Northumberland's estates. My grandfather's a gamekeeper. My grandmother was a chef. My Uncle Albert was the head keeper and stalker. So, and I went to the estate school. And the estate school, when I was, you probably got a prison for this now. we used to go out in our little wellies, our duffel coat and our shorts in the winter to pick brambles. We had a week off to go and pick rose hips because in those days, rose hips had to be given to every child under the age of 12, I think, every day.
Really? Vitamin C.
Yeah. So the Duke's primary school, we all had a week off and we'd go and pick literally tons of rose hips.
Yeah.
And they were sent off to I think we used to send ours to Robinson's. And it was made into rosehip syrup, which were, you could get on prescription from the chemist.
I've never heard that. That is fantastic. I'm a child of the 60s as well, but in our half term, we went potato picking.
Could you imagine now sending a group of school children with their teacher potato picking?
Probably not. No. No. So
but it's a learning curve.
You've got a real good background there in the countryside and understanding the countryside. And this is something that mountain leaders find hard. I suppose as a group, we are probably more urban in our roots. So how do we get to know more about what you know about the countryside?
I mean, I've had a lifetime of building my knowledge up. I hunt, I fish, I shoot. I eat everything I shoot or fish. And I am really passionate about what I do. I think your guys are probably as passionate about what they do. So mixing the two together is difficult, but not insurmountable. It's, as you say, a lot of your guys will come from an urban setting and they want to get out, which is great. Fantastic. And they have got a very channeled vision of where they want to go to. A bit like me, I know what I'm going to do. And I've had some of my friends who are mountain leaders take me up into the hills. I'm not a great high altitude guy. Lived in Switzerland many years ago and I was taken up on some pictures which absolutely scared me witless, hence the grey hair. I think I went grey hair, grey very early. And walking on glaciers freaked me out. Horses for courses. I think I could probably do with learning from some of the mountain leaders a bit more about navigation and that kind of thing. I mean, what I did to get more knowledge about what happens up on the hill, I went away and qualified as a rec on the rec courses, the rescue and emergency care courses.
First aid ones,
And I became an instructor in that. And I'm now FREC 3, first responder. So I think it's recognising what you do and looking at the peripherals of how you can affect what you're doing in the natural world.
So if we were to go for a walk, Dave, and we started in the woods, you know, it could be in the Conwy Valley, just somewhere we know in the Snowdonia here. We walk through some woodland, some native woodland, ideally, before we go onto the mountain. What sort of things would you be looking out for in that native woodland to show us and educate us about those sort of places?
Right, okay. What I do a lot of different things, and it's all geared up to different groups. So if I've got a different group, say predominantly ramblers who will stay in the lowland, I will show them a range of things from wild foods to herbalism and things like that for health. If it was particularly mountain leaders, I would be going on to show them things like if you had to come down, you know, and gain shelter, which is the best place to gain shelter? What's the best place to build shelters for? If you, you know, hopefully they're all kitted up anyways with their two-man boffies and the rest of the stuff that you carry. but, you know, how to bring them down, how to, if you're leading out from, say, the bottom of the Conwy Valley to do a high-level walk, I'd be showing them the things of interest that they could pass on to their clients. We all walk through woods or in any environment. We all walk through environments and we look at the woods, but we don't look into it.
Interesting. So we might recognise, I don't know, hazel and hazelnuts. We might recognise bilberry and bilberries. We might recognise the fact that bog myrtle used to be used to make beer or something. Is it all true, that stuff, or is it just made up in books?
No, it's all true. When you actually look at, say, if we take bilberries, for instance, the actual vitamin C levels in there, the actual calories in there, the actual, not particularly the fruit, the leaf, how you can make a really good tea. If you're coming up through the sort of deciduous woodland and you're coming into predominantly pine woodlands, you know, you can make a really good cup of tea out of pine needles.
Get out of it.
Super rich in vitamin C. Wow. Larch, you can pick the new buds off of the larch and just eat them. And they're like a lemon sweet.
And do you actually do this stuff with people? You know, we often talk about it. We say, oh, you could do this, you could do that. But I don't really, I've never done it. So you actually do this stuff.
Yeah, I think, and again, this comes back to being either a good mountain leader or a good bushcrafter.
Yeah.
Know your subject, be confident with your subject, and only talk about what you know. And if you don't know something, if a client asks you, what is this?
Yeah.
It might be a new knot they're learning. Yeah. And you know, you're not it's not a critical knot.
Yeah.
But it's a nice one to have. And they've seen it on television. Can you show me how to do that knot? I saw on a television program the other day on Discovery Channel. You say, well, if you don't know it, all right, I don't know. You fess up to it. I say all the time, people say, what is that plant? There's thousands of different plants.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. But I use technology. I'll get my iPhone out. I've got an ID. I'll photograph it. If I can't tell them from that, I said, well, okay, I'll get back to you.
Yeah, I've you get to know the ones that you need to know. So so if you're out in the woods here, do you have a particular place where you can go and build shelters and a fire? Do you have to arrange that with a landowner to do that?
Yeah, everywhere that I go to is on permissible ground to me. Yeah. And I make it very, very clear to the landowners what's going to happen and how I shall leave the land the same or better than I found it. If that means repairing a gate or putting a gate back together, I'll do that.
Oh, that's great.
If I've got an impact on the land, I will say to the landowner or the farmer, depends who it is, could be a tenant. So look, that's a bit of a mess. This area's a bit of a mess. I could deal with it being tidying up. For what I want to do, can I come and tidy it up for you? So, for instance, we had up in the Conway Valley, one of the places I go to, there'd been some wild campers, what we class as wild campers.
Yeah, fly camping, I think, is a useful term, isn't it?
Well, it was more like fly tipping, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
There was some pizza boxes. There was a half-drunk bottle of Jack Daniels. And one of these old rock concert pop-up tents. And I said, look, you know, if I see this, I'll clear it away for you.
Yeah.
And we'll get rid of it. I'll bin bag it and we'll get the four-wheel drive up and just get it. I also sort of go along the line of, if I see some people who are there who are not authorised to be there, if they're strayed off the footpaths, I will challenge them in a nice way. I'm not confrontational at all most of the time. We had a group from Liverpool, one of the John Moores University, it was. They're on a field trip and they were way off the track. And there was litter behind them, there's empty bags of quavers behind them, and they were doing field studies. And I basically said to them, you're in the wrong place. This is very private ground. The guy who owns the land wants it kept private. So can you go back to the footpath? Where's that? So got the map out, showed them where they're going. You go up there, and if you go to the top where the star is, and it's going to take you onto the ridge, that's a drover's road. I gave them about the history about it, and they all said, really? And the lecturer who was with them, I didn't know that. So
I'm sure that became a wonderful positive learning experience, and they've all grown from that encounter.
Yeah.
Just take me back to the fire pit there in the woods. What are you going to cook for us, Dave? What is there stuff around there that you can find and cook?
There's loads. It depends how far you really want to go into it. We're not going to be trapping and killing animals, but there's loads of vegetables, all sorts of things. Fungus is the big thing at the minute. For every one inquiry that I get from either a forage or a bushcraft course to go on, I'll probably get four or five people ringing me up. I want you to take me out in the woods and show me all the fungi I can eat.
Yeah.
Absolutely no problem with that. But there's a lot of stuff out there that can kill you.
Yeah.
So we do all the different things, like, you know, we'll show you the parasol mushrooms, which you do get in the uplands of Wales in June, July, August. A very big, tall, they can sit up to a foot off the ground. They look a bit shaggy, but they're absolutely brilliant to eat.
Yeah.
So I can show them them, and you won't, there's nothing else in the fungi world which is poisonous, which looks like that.
Oh, that's handy, isn't it?
So the same with puffballs. Yeah. Brilliant to eat. Brilliant to eat when they're fresh, and we will show you what's not fresh, or talk to what's not fresh and what's a bit manky, don't touch.
Yeah.
There's lots of edible things out there which absolutely taste horrible. Mm. Don't eat them if you unleash them really have to. And the one that gets a lot of people is, I just give them a nettle. I'll pick a nettle with my bare hands and take a leaf off and give them to everybody in the party and say, right, every roll it up in your fingers, and oh, I'm going to get stung. You know, all the roughy-tufty, hairy mountain leaders go, oh, I'm going to get stung. No, you're not. Just roll it in your fingers, then pop it in your mouth and eat it. Will it sting my tongue? No, it won't. Because you've killed the hypodermic needles on them. And they've got, right, what does it taste like? Oh, I don't know. And I'll say, green beans. Wow, it's green beans. It tastes of green beans.
Gosh.
It's got more nutrition in that one leaf than green beans have.
Wow. So we should eat nettles.
Eat nettles. I'm chronic asthmatic. I'm still classed as chronic asthmatic. And I used to, having got one, I usually have one on my table, but he's over Ventolin with me. I went to a bushcraft herbalist down in Norwich, did a weekend's first aid course. And he went around all the people, about 20 people there, and anybody got any issues? Yeah, I'm asthmatic and I have hay fever as well, which is not good for a bushcrafter to have hay fever.
No, really. I can imagine.
That's why I don't feel like summer. And he's, we can give that. Eat a nettle a day. One leaf a day. Yeah. And it's got histamine in it. So it actually causes a very low reaction. So after 3 months, your hay fever and my asthma, it literally died away.
Just from one nettle a day?
One nettle a day. And then say, well, we can't do that in the winter. Pick nettles in the summer, dry them. Make tea, make soup, just make it a drink. Honey, nettle, if you're feeling a bit rough, have some honey and nettles and hot water, a pint glass, let it cool off and just drink it.
Well, I'm going to try again with nettles. I did the cleavers a couple of years ago. I made a curry with the cleavers. That was all right. Yeah, it wasn't bad.
It's the big thing I try and get over to people. Our modern palate, and this is from if you're in your urban environment doing a bit of Subway sandwiches, McDonald's, even to your when you're out in the hills and you've got your was it Pathfinders or Pathway, the packs of food you can buy
the,
from
camp food. Yeah, you can get lots of camp food now.
There's two predominant things in there that pamper to your taste buds: salt and sugar.
Salt and sugar, yeah.
So and I'm digressing a little bit here, but we take people out on a 10-day or 7-day or a 10-day expedition in Scotland in the Carlsa Butte, and we make coracles and sail around, do fishing. It's all wild food.
Wow.
We have a local deer stalker will bring either one or two deer in, mm-hmm. and we'll butcher it, and we'll dry the meat, and we'll earth roast the meat and all sorts of stuff. And we'll spend a whole day collecting shellfish and boil it in seawater in a rock pool with hot rocks.
Yeah.
And we scoff ourselves silly, really.
Sounds amazing, Dave, because you train as a chef as well. Did I see that on your website?
All right. I'll give you a quick potted history of good old Dave.
Yeah.
Lived up in Northumberland, as I said before. We moved to Bedfordshire, the flatlands, which I couldn't cope with. Mm. All my family are military. I declared an interest of joining the Navy, not the Army, which didn't down too well. My grandfather was a regimental sergeant major with a big northern accent. And this is in the 1970 it was.
Yeah.
And I declared to my grandfather, my father wouldn't tell him, so I had to go and tell him, hey, I want to join the Navy and I want to be a cook. And his first words in Geordie were, are you a puff?
Dearing me.
I don't think you can say that. It's not PC.
No, we've moved on.
And I said, no, Grandad. No, Grandpa, yeah. I'm not. And he didn't believe me until I got married. But I went to join, cut it short, went to the Navy. The Navy weren't taking any cooks on at that time. Didn't want to do anything else. I'd signed my articles already. So they had to sign me out. And they gave me a bursary. So I went to college, became a chef. You might hear my dogs barking now. Good night. At school, I was a complete failure. They wouldn't even let me take my mock exams.
Wow.
Left at 15, went to be a chef. I got distinctions and everything across the board. In French, cooking, the whole works. Even postings and mathematics, which I hated, still do. I had some money left from the bursary, so I went to work in Switzerland, in the hotels in Switzerland, which really, I think that was the real trigger point for me. I was the lowest commie chef in the kitchen, so I got all the dirty jobs. I got the jobs of stripping venison carcasses down to get all the rest of the meat off to make hamburgers for the staff to feed on. And I was sent up into the high alpine meadows to collect wild herbs. I was sent down the lake to the local fishermen to bring the fish up, which was called a farer. And I had to take the heads off and gut them. So I got all the crappy jobs.
Yeah.
I was like a pig in muck, really.
Yeah.
And then I processed on, and I became a head chef, and I became what they call a master chef, not what you see on television.
Yeah.
A master chef is a high-tech guy who knows what he's doing, and they don't wear white hats, they wear black hats. So I got to that level, and I went to teach. I taught culinary arts and teaching up to the degree level. Taught a few of the celebrity chefs, a guy in Wales that I was my student for 2 years, Bryn Williams.
He's doing well.
He's doing even better at the minute. He's just bought a place in Switzerland, a restaurant in Switzerland, so he hasn't done too bad.
Very good.
And so I went on like that, and I got more and more into wild food, or teaching wild food, teaching game, and it just went on from there. So that's a sort of substream of what I do. Everybody who comes on my course will eat well.
So there's a good background there. But you did change career at some point, didn't you, as well? So because you do have another job during the day. You're not a bushcrafter the time, are you?
I must. People listen to this like, what does he do? How does he do that? A lot of people say to me, even the guys in the office when I used to work in an office, said, why do you do this, Dave? Because I was quite content being a good quality lecturing chef.
Yeah.
But the thing that really knocked me was hygiene. And it was when hygiene standards were changing. Yeah. So I was quite verbose and vocal about the state of hygiene that they were teaching to students. Mm-hmm. And the college I worked in said, well, that's a good idea. Can you come on the health and safety committee for the group? Mm. So I said, yeah. And I learned a bit of health and safety and I got a bit more verbose about that. And they said, right, if we offered the job, would you become the safety manager? I said, the right money, yeah, fine. And she basically turned out, right, you've got it. So I trained up in that. And I did that for a few years, which was riveting stuff, great stuff. People's health and safety. Ooh. And part of that was environmental management, industrial environmental management. And I basically got up to being a chartered professional, which I still am today. So I'm a 50-50 person.
Yeah.
50% of the time I'm out in the country doing what I do, bushcrafting. 50% I'm advising. I'm away from the college these days. I run my own business in health and safety. I run lots of events, which is my big thing. Rock concerts, country fairs, all sorts of things. At the minute, I'm one of the COVID advisors, which local council see me coming in the door going, oh no, here's Dave again. He's going to interpret what's just been said in Parliament to us and bore us, Richard. It's good. It's good. I take the view, which I suspect, especially your mountain leaders, because I know what they go through in. I did the Lowland Leader course, which is a lot lower.
Yeah, I did that. So that's good.
People said, oh, you should go and be a mountain leader. I said, no, it's not. That's about out of my limit. I've done enough. But I take everything I do very seriously. And like I said before, it's know what you do and be confident about what you do. I talk to bushcrafters about, when I've gone to seminars and things like that, about risk assessment. And I go, really? We're just out in the woods. Yeah, but you've got axes, you've got knives, people get lost.
Yeah.
The whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
Do the paperwork, work on it, and you're a better person for it. You're a better bushcrafter. Yeah. Like you'll be a better leader doing your dynamic risk assessments if you're going out looking at the weather forecasts. Are we going to go up there, really? No, we're not.
Exactly. Yeah. Dynamic risk assessment is very important in what we do because conditions and groups change all the time. I'm just sat here slightly chuckling that a bloke who lights fires in the wood for half his living spends the other half being a health and safety advisor. But presumably, you're very careful where you light your fires.
That's the thing that, particularly with fires, and particularly with changing weather patterns, it is really, really, if you haven't got permission, if you don't know what you're doing, do not light a fire. You've got plenty of things you can cook with nobody's in a position really have to use that a fire for life-saving potential. You're never that far away from a road in this country. You're never that far away from help if you've got the right gear and you've got the right knowledge.
In England and Wales, I presume you'd need a landowner's permission to light a campfire anyway. It's not something you can just do willy-nilly, is it?
No, anything to do with lighting fires or taking vegetables from the woods or the seashore, you need the permission. You can take a bilberry off and eat it, fine. But once you start uprooting it, that's a criminal offence. It's illegal.
So it's collecting the fruit in those places where it's fine. And of course, it's a leave no trace principle. We talk a lot about leave no trace, countryside code. Presumably, there's a bushcrafters and foragers code as well.
We're the same. The bushcrafters, all the good bushcrafters are members of IOL, and there's a bushcraft section for IOL.
Institute of Outdoor Learning, we should just say that.
Institute of Outdoor Learning. And the Institute's got specialist groups that I'm a member of the bushcraft group. We all get together and we sit around the table or around the fire, wherever we are. We usually try and do our meetings out in a field or a woodland somewhere. And we share all our experiences and our do's and don'ts and what's happened to us. And we share good practice. You know, the last meeting I was at, there was a guy showing us how to bake bread. And I thought, I'm a chef, I know how to bake bread. And this guy wiped the floor with me. He had some old enamel pots that he put on the fire. And I'm going, no, that's not really going to work. It was brilliant.
Wow, so, that's interesting.
I always take the point that you don't know everything. In fact, you probably know not a lot.
I suspect that's the case, yeah. Dave, the coastal wanderer as well. Why the coast? Is the coast richer pickings? I mean, why do you choose that name?
By far. Most people want to go into the woods and look at the woods and pick some jelly ears off an elder and we can eat them. And people say, I've tried those. They blew up in a pan when I did it. Yeah. Hot oil everywhere. Yeah, just cut them in half. They don't do that. And make sure there's no earwigs in it and things like that. But on the shore, on a good bit of shoreline, we can go out and an hour, we can probably pick, three or four of us, we can pick probably 5 kilos of shellfish.
Gosh.
And seaweed and shore vegetables. There's more, more chance of getting really good... really good fresh vegetables. If you know the Conway River is not too far away from here, in the right season, I can go and pick 2 kilos of samphire, marsh grass.
Yeah,
absolutely brilliant stuff. Pickles really well, freezes well, blanchet freezer. I can't pick more than 2 kilos. That's a legal requirement.
I was going to say, how do you manage its sustainability? So there's a limit to how much you can pick, is there?
You need to know how much you can pick. It's usually around about 1 kilo or 2 kilos, depending if you're picking shellfish or vegetables. The thing you need to know about sustainability, and this will go for your mountain leaders as well, know your environment and what impact you can load onto that environment without damaging it. So if you've got a field of marsh samphire, if it's very short and it's not looking very good, don't pick there. It's short for a reason, nutrients, maybe pollution, whatever. If it's good, succulent, pick some, but don't go overboard. I've seen guys Clint Craftnant this autumn, I saw one guy picking slippery jack mushrooms, and he had bags for life, as does bags for life. He had 4 or 5 of them, and if you put a mushroom into plastic bags, they just sweat and they'll go in 10 minutes. And he was sitting on the side of the road stripping the stalks off them and throwing the stalks away. Just, I said, why have you done that? Well, the stuff I get home is probably still good enough to freeze. So why don't you get a cotton bag, pick a kilo, actually, as you pick them, take the stalk off and put it back where you found it.
Yeah.
And put the actual flowering head in the bag, or even have a basket and walk away. And all that 1 kilo of stuff you pick will be good to eat or freeze.
It's frustrating, isn't it? So with the IOL, the Institute of Outdoor Learning, there are qualifications, aren't there? Presumably they cover a lot of this stuff, do the qualifications?
Yeah. Well, there's within IOL itself, there's a path you can take to become a good bushcrafter.
Yeah.
You know, you have to join IOL, so you're going to be in the outdoor business anyways. So there are paths you can get there. And there are all sorts of different professions highlighted within IOL. So you can pick and choose who you want to go and see, really. There's a directory of, like, the bushcrafters. There's people who will specialise in Neolithic history.
Oh, yeah?
A guy called Will Lord, as mad as a box of bats, absolutely off his trolley. But he trained Ed Stafford.
He's on the telly, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. And Ed Stafford and Will, they did a thing in China where they race against each other. I'm not a particular fan of television bushcraft, to be honest, but
yeah.
I watched it because I know Will very well.
Yeah.
And they did 5 days in the bamboo forest in China and climbing rock faces and things like that with nothing. Will made his own knife out of a stone and got food and things like that. And Ed Stafford nearly died.
That's a TV game thing, isn't it? And there are threats to what we do, though, aren't there? You know, as a climber, it's always painful when the local media posts about mad climbers and brave mountain rescuers. As a wild camper myself, you know, a low impact, remote, leave no trace. When the headlines about wild camping, it's quite frustrating. You've got all this going on as well in the bushcraft world, haven't you? You know, idiots, mad people doing this. How do you cope with all that?
Education.
Yeah.
I don't want to insult any city or anything like that, but we do get
people, Dave.
You get the urbanite coming out and either coming onto the beach with a throwaway.
Oh, don't. Disposable barbecue.
Yeah. Right up to the, I do go walking up in Snowdon and in the Snowdon Range on regular times. And I go through the ruins of the slate quarries and the slate buildings. Mm. And there's excrement in there. Mm. And there's empty can of beans and things like that.
Yeah.
It's not beyond the will of man, or the wit of man, shall I say, to say, I'm leaving a mess here.
Yeah, it is really frustrating.
What gets me, the frustrating bit is, they know they're doing it, but they don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I do some teaching occasionally with MOD, just guys who are going forward for instructors in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah.
And decompression with the Royal Navy from submariners. I run a course with a friend of mine up in Scotland where we decompress mariners who have just come up after 3 months.
Nice.
And you think these guys are switched on. They're not. You know, they'll leave a mess.
So you would imagine they were trained not to leave a trace of where they've been. Surely that's instrumental in what they're doing.
I think it's a disjoint, really.
Yeah.
It's seen on a... When we got the army out, it's a civilian course. It's a bit of a freebie. It's a fun do.
Mm.
You haven't got a sergeant major shouting at you.
Mm.
But it's that way of thinking. I can go out here. They wouldn't do it in their own back garden, but they would go to Moor Vamai or Snowdon itself and just leave a mess.
It's bad. And it's really hard one to tackle, isn't it? I think, as you say, education is a key way forward. I suspect we could do with a bit more funding of wardens and rangers and that sort of thing as well, just getting messages out.
I think, you know, we in the 70s, 80s and early 90s, we had a lot of money put into the country code.
Yeah.
And, you know, shut the gate was a bit of a contentious thing where was leave the gate as it is.
You leave the gate as it's found, If in doubt, leave it shut, though, because that's less of a difference.
Yeah. And I really think we could go back into schools and start to teach kids. I take kids with special needs and special issues out into the woods, and I show them basic firelighting and basic shelter building and things like that. And the people, the staff that come with them say, don't show them firelighting because they might go back and burn their home down or whatever they're being cared for. It's never happened.
No.
And they are so... And I take up groups from youth clubs, schools. They are so switched on what they're getting. Mm. And if you say, right, you don't do this at home, I'm going to show you what to do. We'll do it. We'll have a fire. Right. Do you understand that? And they, and they take it home and they're fine. And they go home and they tell their parents everything about it, how they were eating woodlice off a branch. did you know it's a land prawn?
Oh, wow.
And the parents come back and say, did my son really do that? Did he eat? He won't eat peas, but he had an insect with you. Yeah, that's it.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I love it.
And it's coming back to education and also, I hate to trash it, but a lot of things you see on television are not what you see, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know. People don't realise it's a TV show rather than an educational thing, so it's much better to show people how to do it correctly.
We're coming
towards the end of our time now. I just want to talk back to mountain leaders. So, as a bushcrafter, a serious, respected, professional bushcrafter, what sort of messages would you have for mountain leaders, how they could be better at what they do?
Right, okay. One of the things, and this is not particularly for mountain leaders to start with, but it's anybody who's got a load on their back.
Mm-hmm.
And mountain leaders will always have a load on the back because of what they're required to carry, even for a small jaunt out. You have a natural sort of thing, right? We're going from point A to point B. We're going to get there. It's about an hour's walk, a day's walk, whatever. You've all got your kit on your back, and you're going to follow a path, which is good practice. I would suggest have more regular stops and just get together with your clients, chat, and just ask them to have a look around. What do you see? And as long as that mountain leader can actually talk to, Craig Cluard up on Penn.
Tam of Echen above there.
Yeah. How it was one of the world centres for Stone Age axes. And they've been found in Turkey. Those have been traded all the way to Turkey.
From Samavachan, Pemachno. Good grief.
Yeah,
not Pemachno.
Or if you're talking, if you're standing there, you can talk about that. And then you can talk about the Great Orm, about where they think that was the first bronze smelting in Europe. And they're still found some ember or ashes and scorching of a rock in a particular place, which I've never been told where it is, so I can't find it. The goats on the Great Orm, they need to be able to talk about what they see.
The place they're in,
if you're up going up into the Slate area, the history about Slate.
Yeah.
It's the background knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, I think absolutely. It's so much more about health and safety, isn't it?
You do your health and safety. You do your health and safety, but the bomb, which covers you. You get your...
Absolutely.
After the accident, were you briefed? Did you understand it? Yeah. Did you say yes? Yeah. Yes, I did. Mm. Yeah. So that bit's done. It's sort of, if the mountain leader sees something like a peregrine go by, just hang on a minute. Have a look at that. That's a peregrine. Fastest bird in the world.
Fantastic.
It's that broader knowledge.
Yeah, I think so.
This is a bilberry bush. Everybody stop and pick one and eat one. Have a chat about it. And then you can actually put in, but right, we've done that. So unless you're going to pick them and eat them on the way, which is fine if you find some other ones, this is what, you know, they're not rare, but they're not common these days, as common as they were. You know, go gentle with them. Don't stand on them.
Yeah.
It's all that inherent knowledge. Yeah. And I'm sure that, you know, if you're going up across Crib Goch, I wouldn't expect you to stop and have a little chat halfway across.
There's not much to eat up there either.
No, but it's pick your points, make it interesting.
Yeah.
It's extra learning that the client's getting.
Yeah.
If you get extra learning about that, and they go and buy a book from Food for Free, which is a really good small book. Always take that. It's a more fulfilled and holistic journey they've been on.
Brilliant.
You know,
yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, Dave, but I can definitely see a bushcrafting foraging workshop for mountain leaders appearing in our program at some point in the future. But for now, let's just say thank you very much today, Phillips. And if they want to find out more, it's the Coastal Wanderers, the website, isn't it?
Yeah, Coastal Wanderer. If you want to see a lot more images and interact with myself, Dave Phillips or David Phillips, Coastal Wanderer on Coastal Facebook. Wanderer.
That's great. Thank you very much indeed, Dave. Diolch yn fawr.
Thank you. Anytime. And be safe out there. Health and safety.